You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, a new poll shows most young Americans think our democracy is in trouble or failing. As the country marks the first anniversary of the January 6th insurrection, you'll get a look ahead to the future and hear from America's youngest voters. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, family farmers have faced tough times in recent years, and that's not the first time. The 1980s farm crisis brought rising costs for farmers along with severe weather that damaged crops. And a federal agency designed to assist farmers was threatening many of them with foreclosure and the prospect of losing their farms altogether. That kicked off a legal fight against the federal government, spearheaded by our next guest in a case known as Coleman versus Block. We're talking about the story behind that case and what lessons it has for the challenges facing farmers today. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the 1980s farm crisis? Did you or maybe someone in your family lose the family farm during that time or come close to it? Do you see parallels between what family farms went through in the 80s, what they're seeing right now? If you work in farming or agriculture, we'd love to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah Vogel is the former commissioner of agriculture in North Dakota. She was the first woman in U.S. history elected to that position in any state. She tells the story of her legal fight in her new book, The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine, and the Fight to Save the Family Farm. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. It's a treat to be here.
And I wanted to set the stage, first of all, farmers facing tough times, family farmers in North Dakota for a variety of reasons. Then there's this change of administration and a policy from the federal government in the early years of the Reagan administration when it came to farm loans through the Farmers Home Administration. What was the big change that really set the stage for your court case?
It was the appointment of David Stockman as the director of Office of Management and Budget. He believed that the government had no business lending to farmers or to other small businesses, and he set up really severe delinquency reduction quotas for reducing the debt. And that those instructions went from him to Secretary Block to Charles Schumann, who ran the Farmers Home Administration. And the net result was basically a quota where every state had to achieve roughly 25% reduction in delinquent loans in a matter of months over the winter of 1982. And it set off a tsunami of foreclosures all across the country. And I was a lawyer. Just returned from a career in Washington, D.C. I was in North Dakota working with farmers, and I saw the real life impacts of that policy on many of my clients.
Yeah, we just heard the big picture there. Can you zoom in now? For the farmers who became your clients, what did this policy mean to them? What did it look like?
Oh, it was awful. They were going along, having tough times, which, happens periodically in agriculture. And all of a sudden, one day, they would write a check and it would bounce. Or they'd go to the bank to withdraw money and there'd be no money in the bank account. And that's because Farmers Home had seized the money from their bank account. From that point forward, no money would be released to them for any purpose. If they sold a crop, all the money went to Farmers Home. Nothing went for the farmer. Nothing went to, pay their bills to Main Street. It all went back to Farmers Home in this attempt to reduce their delinquency. And in the result, they were starving the farmers off the farms. They were told, you have one choice. It's to quit farming voluntarily or we'll foreclose on you. Those were the only two choices farmers were being given. And it was happening to many, many thousands of farmers all over the country. It was really brutal.
A farmer in that position, of course, can't go out and hire a high-priced attorney. How did you end up being their last resort in a lot of ways?
Well, I'd been sort of programmed from birth. My family belonged to the Nonpartisan League, which was a political party pretty unique to North Dakota, but it did spread out in the early teens to a number of states, including Wisconsin, and Minnesota, and even Canada. And the Nonpartisan League believed that government should be very supportive of farmers, and the power of government belonged to the voters. So, and their main premise in the Nonpartisan League was that the duty of government to support family farmers. They were the lifeblood of North Dakota. So I grew up in this political party, and part of the legend, of it's because it was history, it was true, is that the Nonpartisan League did a lot for the farmers in the 1930s. The governor of North Dakota, Governor Langer, declared a moratorium on all farm foreclosures. Leaders, national leaders in the U.S. Congress were Nonpartisan Leaguers, and they helped get laws passed that helped farmers. So when this cataclysm hit, and I had just returned to North Dakota from working on the East Coast for about 10 years, I felt like I had no option. I had to help these farmers. I just had to. And I didn't realize at the time how incredibly difficult it would be, because by definition, every single one of my clients had not one penny to pay me. So they were bringing me fish that they caught and vegetables from the garden, and they would take gas from their on-farm storage and, give me $5 or $10, or sometimes they would borrow money from relatives and use it to pay me. But it was pretty tough. I mean, I was as poor as they were, but we worked together and we were pretty passionate about what we were doing.
We're talking to Sarah Vogel. Her new book is The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine and the Fight to Save the Family Farm, about a pivotal case in the 1980s with farm foreclosures coming from the federal government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience to share, maybe from that era or of the challenges facing your family farm, maybe right now, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Bill is with us in Sun Prairie. Bill, hello.
Yes, this is Bill in Sun Prairie. Wanted to tell the story about our family farm. My dad died in 1984 from, emphysema. And my mother was left with the farm. Two of my brothers were trying to make a go of it, and because of low prices, they had to file bankruptcy. Well, the Farmers Home Administration was in the process of foreclosing. Well, later on in the later 80s, Farmers Home Administration come out with a program where they would buy down their debt. In other words, you could pay off up to 50% of the debt, and the debt would be considered paid off. Well, I was able to negotiate a bank loan for my mother and sign the farm up into the CRP program. That was paying the debt, or paying off the bank each year. My mother then sold 240s, mostly wooded areas, which most farmers weren't interested in at that time, and paid off that debt. She was able then to live off of that income from that farm for close to 20 years before she passed away. And we just sold the last 110 acres about 3 years ago, and it was paid off last year. And the family got roughly $37,000. A family of 11 got roughly $37,000 each out of that farm remaining,
Bill, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Sarah, what that makes me think is, he said those options came along later in the 80s. For your clients, they were not being presented with really any options, right?
That's right. What the caller just talked about came as a result of the 1987 Ag Credit Act, and that was that saved many, many, many farmers. It was these were desperate times, and eventually Congress came to the rescue with quite a few debt restructuring options that saved a lot of farmers. But when I filed the case, none of that was on the horizon yet.
Bill, thanks again for sharing that story. We're talking to Sarah Vogel about her new book, The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine and the Fight to Save the Family Farm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about your own family's farm back in the 80s or today, the challenges, maybe the legal challenges facing you or financial, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sarah Vogel about her new book, The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine and the Fight to Save the Family Farm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe if you have a personal story or a family story to share of the challenges facing farmers, your own family maybe, in the 1980s or beyond, 800-642-1234 is the number. Sarah, let's pick things up back the case now. You're the lawyer here, not getting paid a lot for these farmers who don't have anything to spend. What kind of things did you discover when it came to how these, especially these local county agents or supervisors were dealing with these farmers?
Well, they tended to be, it was a bureaucracy, and they tended to follow orders from on high. So Stockman ordered Block, and he ordered Truman to do the different things. It went down to the state office, and then it went to the county offices. And, so the initiative to do these dreadful things to farmers did not come from the grassroots people. It came from on top, but they felt they had to follow orders. In subsequent years, I've learned that many people quit working at Farmers Home because they couldn't bear doing that. But that's how it came about. It came from Washington, D.C. It did not come from the countryside.
Let's go back to our callers now. Greg is with us in Jefferson. Greg, hi.
Hi. Thanks, sir. I have a question. Do you think there was anything in the mid-70s, early 70s that sort of led decisions maybe out of the USDA or out of Washington that sort of led farmers to overextend? My family's farm shrunk from about 900 acres to 200 in the early 80s. And it was just like your thoughts about that.
Greg, thanks for the call. We also heard via email from Jim in Cedarburg wondering about the impact of the Nixon and Earl Butts farm bill in working up to this. So can you set the stage for us a little bit in the 1970s before the change in the 80s that set the stage here?
Yeah, they were... they were basically preaching from Washington, get big or get out. More and more and more people were supposed to get bigger, sell more. Land values were going up, up, up. They're, really strong markets in Russia. And then all of a sudden things came to a crashing halt. And there was, it was just devastating. So many people had borrowed money in good times, and then suddenly the rug was pulled out from under them. And it's kind of a lesson in overexpansion as well as overcontraction. So I was not worried so much with the overall economic themes. I just felt that these particular farmers, the ones I was working with, had been given a very, very bad deal. And there were laws that USDA was supposed to be following, and they were supposed to be following the Constitution. So, yeah, I mean, they could seek to foreclose on the farmer, but they had to follow the law. They had to follow the rules, and they weren't. So the lawsuit was saying there was a law called the 1980, it was a law passed in the Carter era that gave farmers the right to apply for deferral when they were temporarily unable to pay due to circumstances beyond their control. And USDA was not implementing that law. Moreover, they were not following the Constitution. They were not providing due process to those farmers and taking away their property. So the lawsuit that I brought with the help of the nine farmers, who were the North Dakota Nine, they were the lead plaintiffs. Eventually, it moved from nine lead plaintiffs to over 240,000 farmers nationwide and stopped many tens of thousands of farm foreclosures across the country. But, it was a difficult It was very difficult times.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. This is a long uphill process. What ultimately happened in this case? What was the ruling that, as you said, ultimately prevented many foreclosures?
We had a wonderful judge, Judge Bruce M. Van Sickle, who had grown up in the 30s. He was a Republican. He was a compassionate and fair person. And he listened to our arguments and he heard us. And he said that, yes, the federal government has to follow the law. The federal government has to follow the Constitution. And he gave us a preliminary injunction stopping USDA from foreclosure until they provided farmers with a chance to apply for deferral and required them to follow the Constitution if they wanted to collect against the farmer. And that injunction was first in North Dakota, and then over the summer of 1983, there were so many calls from all over the country that eventually because by then I had other lawyers helping me too, by then we expanded it into a national class action. And so it expanded to cover all farmers nationwide that borrowed from Farmers Home Administration. And at the end of the day, I think there were 16,000 farm cases already in court or heading to court. And so Judge Van Sickle's settlement, his injunction protected all those farmers from further actions by USDA. So USDA had to send all those foreclosure cases back to the countryside, reopen the loan processing process. And then Congress in 1987 stepped in and set into place actual debt settlement procedures and, you know, really help farmers dig their way out of the morass that so many were in. The farmers, I want to emphasize that the farmers were producing as much and very well. I mean, it was not that they were inefficient or improvident. They were the best farmers, and they tended to be younger too, because older farmers had less debt. Younger farmers had gone to Farmers Home and borrowed. So it was a whole generation of farmers that were threatened by these actions of the federal government in the early 80s. It was pretty darn dramatic.
We're talking to Sarah Vogel, author of the new book, The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine and the Fight to Save the Family Farm. Sarah, most of your book is looking at this case in the 80s. You also have your eye, though, on the modern day. We hear here in Wisconsin, bigger farms doing okay, a lot of new smaller farms doing all right. The medium-sized family farm, a worry here and a worry for you. Why is that?
Well, it's, you know, the very smallest of farms can often find off-farm employment to support the farm family. And the very largest firms, you know, they borrow from big banks or Wall Street, or, you know, they make it, the very biggest. But it's the ones in the middle, the middle-sized family farms, the backbone of America, the ones that the founding fathers believed democracy could not survive without. Those are the ones in trouble. And I wrote the book because I want to waken people up to the importance of family farmers to our democracy, to our society, to our survival. And I think COVID has certainly demonstrated that, you know, when there are shortages of food and, you know, you don't want to wait for products to be shipped in from Japan or China or Europe. You know, it's better if it's grown nearby. And so we're at a crisis point. And I think there are many, many good things that are going on now, and we all need to support them. In the end of the book, I recommend that people go to, say, the Farm Aid website and look at all the local organizations that are working to save family farms. The National Farmers Union, the Wisconsin Farmers Union, those are also great organizations. There's an entity called the Farmers Legal Action Group that was founded as a part of the 1980s farm crisis. And they're there to help lawyers. You know, if farmers need legal help, there are legal resources that they could use. And I really wrote the book maybe to provide hope to people that in prior very, very tough times, many people did make it through. Many people did survive. Many people were given hope by actions of Congress or what I did in court or what other lawyers did and other farmers and farm organizations. So there's always hope, and people should reach out. And I know today, you know, there are suicide hotlines and, you know, sources. There are places for people to reach out. And I hope that people who are in distress do reach out for help, because there may be very well help. It's very uneven too. I want to emphasize that, like, dairy farmers, I think, are particularly distressed. Beginning farmers are particularly distressed. So it varies by region. So you shouldn't look at just national statistics. You need to look at the people and how they are.
And that's a good place to leave it. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's wonderful talking to you, Rob. Thank you so much.
You too. That's Sarah Vogel, the author of The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine, and The Fight to Save the Family Farm. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, many members of Congress have investments in stocks and other financial assets that raise concerns about conflicts of interest. A new report digs into the potential conflicts facing current members of the House and Senate. We'll find out what they found out. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League says we can all work to shut down hate in America and prevent some of the social breakdowns that hatred can lead to. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Green Bay's mayor says the head of a Republican-backed investigation into the 2020 election made false statements. We'll get the details and hear what the Republican leadership in the state Senate has to say about the ongoing investigation. First, earlier today, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris spoke to mark the first anniversary of the insurrection that took place at the U.S. Capitol. Here's a little of Vice President Harris's remarks delivered from Statuary Hall outside the House chamber.
What the extremists who roamed these halls targeted was not only the lives of elected leaders. What they sought to degrade and destroy was not only a building, hallowed as it is. What they were assaulting were the institutions, the values, the ideals that generations of Americans have marched, picketed, and shed blood to establish and defend.
Our next guest says the events of January 6th of last year are just one result of a buildup of unchecked intolerance and hate in the United States. He's worried that hate is on the rise and could have more and increasingly bad consequences. But there's good news. He says that everyday people can do a lot to help turn the tide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about, do you see a rising tide of hatred and intolerance in the country? Do you see this as a big problem? And what do you want to see done about it? Do you take action in your local community? What do you want to see from the government, social media platforms, and others? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jonathan Greenblatt, a CEO of the Anti-Defamation League and author of the new book just out this week called It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You mentioned January 6th of last year multiple times in your book. Can you share your thoughts on this anniversary, especially as it relates to hate and intolerance, the subject of your book?
Well, I think January 6th is an incredibly solemn anniversary, and one that I think all Americans, regardless of how you vote or where you sit on a political spectrum, need to take very seriously. This was what I would describe as not just a terror attack, but the most predictable terror attack in American history, because the perpetrators literally said in advance that their goal was to subvert the democratic process, to interrupt the election certification, and their use of weapons and their the employment of violent rhetoric and their effort to try to capture and kidnap and potentially kill legislators is something that we need to take very, very seriously. But unfortunately, I would say this was really the culmination of 5 years of increasing, amplifying, intensifying polarization and the normalization of extremism in this country. And so while I think many were stunned by what happened that day, we were certainly at ADL shocked, but not at all surprised, because we tracked the extremists and we knew, again, this is what they were planning. This is what they were saying they would do. And we watched it come to pass.
You mentioned the normalization of hatred, ideas that might have seemed fringe and been only seen on the margins, becoming more and more, in some ways, mainstream. How did that happen?
Well, I think there are multiple factors that contribute to the moment we're in today, the rise of extremism and illiberalism. Number one, I think we have political figures who have employed extremism as a, not just a tactic to use on occasion, but a strategy to try to inflame their base and divide the nation. Starts with President Trump. And I don't really care how you vote. I care in terms of what you value. And the president's repeated use of racist rhetoric, of divisive language, employing various stereotypes, and literally giving license to some of the worst elements of society. I mean, when given the chance after Charlottesville, he talked about very fine people. When given the chance in a presidential debate to condemn the Proud Boys, he asked them to stand back and stand by. And then, of course, on the heels of the insurrection, as has been, you know, documented now by the January 6th Joint Committee, he literally told the rioters, after hours and hours of waiting, that he, quote unquote, loved them. I mean, there is simply no precedent, but the president and other elected officials' willingness to engage in extremists is one reason why we have this problem. I think, secondly, we have a much higher degree of polarization today. Communities are divided, you know, lingering socioeconomic inequities, the persistence of, you know, extremists now in the political conversation has divided not just, you know, our cities and towns, but families and circles of friends. Over and over, I hear these stories all over the U.S. And then finally, I think social media has a lot to do with why we are where we are today. I mean, whereas once, like, you know, Wisconsin Public Radio, we had a news media that were more responsible with editorial processes and standards and practices and ombudsman. Today, Facebook is kind of feeding intravenously fictions and lies, you know, into the bloodstream. And the idea that millennials and Gen Z are getting their news not from, you know, NPR, if you will, but from TikTok should deeply terrify all of us.
Talking to Jonathan Greenblatt about his new book, It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Jonathan, we'll talk more about possible solutions in a bit. I want to hear your definition of the it, and it could happen here. What is the unthinkable? What do you worry if we don't take the right kind of actions? What do you worry that this leads to?
Well, look, I'm speaking to you today, you know, nestled here in New York City, but the reality is I'm the grandson of a Holocaust survivor from Germany, you know, from a Jewish family who my grandfather, when he was a young man, could never have imagined that the only country he ever would have known, he ever knew, would one day turn on him, regard him as an enemy of the state, destroy everything that he loved, and slaughter almost his entire family and friends. And I speak to you today as the husband of a political refugee from Iran, whose family had lived there for, they would say, thousands of years. And it was the only country they had ever known. And they never would have imagined that after the Islamic Revolution, that the government would regard them as enemies of the state, that it would destroy everything that they loved and force them to flee for their lives. So whether it was in Iran, in the Middle East, in the 1980s, or it was in Nazi Germany, in Europe in the 1930s, as a Jewish person, as a human being, we've seen stable societies shift almost overnight and come apart at the seams, and demagogues divide communities to marginalize individuals, and we watch communities erupt into civil war. And so what could happen here? From the demonization of immigrants to the attacks on Asian Americans to the, again, rise of anti-Semitism that we've seen in recent years, I think we are more vulnerable than we might realize. And I believe all of this too could unravel if we don't take steps to stop it. And that's really why I wrote the book.
Let's start talking about some of those steps now. And some of it can start on a very personal level. You talk about how we can confront and counsel people for expressing bias, for expressing hatred, maybe even out of ignorance. What can we do in our day-to-day lives if it's that that relative or that coworker we're talking to?
Well, that's a really good question and an important point. I mean, I think all of us have the power to stop hate. There's no silver bullet, right? There's no magic wand that we can wave that will end intolerance. I mean, I guess that's quite obvious. But the ADL is the oldest anti-hate organization in the United States. We've been doing this work for well over 100 years. And I say that because I wrote the book to share strategies and tactics and tips that we found that work. And it is indeed a whole of society approach that we need. Right? It's an all hands on deck moment that requires, you know, schools and businesses and faith communities and government and individuals. So what can we do? Well, as individuals, when we see hate happen, number one, we've got to call it out. Like literally, whether it's at the water cooler or in the locker room or at the kitchen table, I think all of us need to interrupt intolerance when it happens. That's important to enforce norms like, you know, compassion and kindness. I think number two, I really believe we've got to cancel culture altogether. We've got to lose the litmus tests. This idea today where we excommunicate people because of the idea that they make a single mistake. I mean, my Jewish faith teaches me that everyone has the power of redemption and can amend for their errors. And I think we need to embrace that ethos. And then number three, I think we deeply need to reinvest in civil society. Literally, whether it's volunteering or voting or participating in a political process to push back on the people who would suppress the right to vote, you know, the people who would try to come to a school board meeting and bully people into about conspiracies on masks or whatever kind of craziness. All of us need to realize that democracy is not a spectator sport that you can watch from the cheap seats and everything will work out. No. We have to be on the field. We all have to play the game if we want this to go in the right direction.
We're talking to Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, looking at his new book out this week. It's called It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see, as our guest does, this rising tide of public intolerance and hate? What solutions would you suggest? What questions do you have for our guest? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, author of the new book, It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dan is with us in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Remember that when all this stuff takes place, the economics of whatever country is in is pretty much destroyed. Because Americans are, I mean, human beings are nice when things are going well. When things aren't going well, the human beings, things go south really quick. But as far as the situation in Washington, what Thomas Jefferson says, you have to have an informed populace, otherwise you don't have a democracy. All the mainstream media outlets across the board in this country have not done their job. Otherwise, you wouldn't even have people like that thinking that way. That means that your democracy is pretty much broken just because of what Thomas Jefferson says.
Dan, thanks for the call. Jonathan, mainstream media fell down on the job here, Dan says.
Well, it's certainly true that I think we can criticize mainstream media because there are always biases. There are always holes in coverage. There are always stories that get missed. But I'm of the opinion that the mainstream media generally does a pretty good job. Sure, you can watch some of the cable news stations and get trapped in a filter bubble that only look at things from the left or the right. But the reality is, on a day-to-day basis, I think a lot of the mainstream media, from New York Times to the Washington Post to the Journal, do, I think, a pretty good job of calling out, have done a pretty good job of keeping government and keeping business honest. Now, that being said, I think the evaporation of local news media has been a big problem. And I think, again, Facebook and Craigslist and the internet has gobbled that up without any recourse. And of course, there are loopholes that allow them to evade the same kind of responsibility that local news has always had. More local news would help to, I think, bind our communities better together at the local level.
Dan, thanks for the call. We'll go to Dwayne next in Wausau. Dwayne, hi.
Oh, hi. So I saw on the news today that one of the mothers of one of the guys going to be getting sentenced for the insurrection said it all started when he started absorbing, like, Rush Limbaugh, Alex Jones, that guy from InfoWars, who was the one that said, was it Parkland, that was a false flag where these were actors, none of the kids got killed. I mean, and it's scary that these people will believe that, you know, or Americans will believe that they just didn't have the common sense of knowledge to know that, you know, there were lives taken that day and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't actors and it wasn't set up so that affect gun control and people going down these rabbit hole websites. Like some guy in his computer can say to his wife, oh, honey, look, I just found something that the top epidemiologist and the, you know, all the scientists have missed.
I gotcha, Dwayne. Thanks for the call. Jonathan, Dwayne pointing at, conservative media, but also particularly conspiracy theory media and internet.
Dwayne is entirely correct. And so, again, I think there are extremes on both sides, but Fox News and, you know, Newsmax and AON putting out this madness that what happened a year ago today wasn't a terror attack or an insurrection, and the willingness of mainstream media to take people like Alex Jones, who is not, he's not even a, to call him a journalist isn't not only wrong, he's not even an effective performer. I mean, he is like a bad actor, knowingly promoting lies. Again, and this, the caller was referring to Sandy Hook and his propounding, creating the conspiracy that Sandy Hook didn't happen. I mean, I think the fact that Facebook and Twitter and these other services have moved these people from the margins into the mainstream, that their algorithms are engineered to inflame and amplify the worst kind of content because it drives clicks, is beyond reproach. And I really do believe, much like big tobacco, much like big oil, these companies need to be addressed from a regulatory perspective, broken up, and held responsible for the damage they're doing to society.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jonathan Greenblatt is with us talking about his new book, It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Jonathan, a lot of concern on the January 6th anniversary with hatred on the right. You make a point in the book of calling out where you see things like especially anti-Semitism appearing on the left, mm-hmm. and hoping mm-hmm. people on the left can police their own. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, there's no doubt, like, the extreme right has a propensity to be violent. If you look at the extremist-related murders over the last decade, the overwhelming majority, 75 to 80%, were committed by people we would characterize as right-wing extremists, be they white supremacists, sovereign citizens, anti-government activists, armed militia members. Nonetheless, there is also intensifying intemperance among the far left. And I think it manifests in many different ways, but the sort of illiberalism and the kind of thought policing that occurs and the norms that are brought about and enforced can explode as well. And we saw this last May after the fighting in Gaza, where you had Jews being beaten up in broad daylight simply for the crime of wearing a kippah or being visibly identifiable as Jewish. Now, make no mistake, you can have strong feelings about what Israel's policies are. I know that I do, or in events in the Middle East. But beating up Jewish people is not a rational response, just like you could have strong feelings about what the government in Beijing is doing to the Uyghur population in China, or to the Tibetan population, or clamping down on a democracy in Hong Kong, or so on and so forth. But that's not an excuse to beat up elderly Asian people. And yet the people committing those crimes weren't wearing MAGA hats. They weren't white supremacists. They were overwhelmingly coming from anti-Israel events. And they characterized themselves more often than not as progressive. And yet we didn't have major progressive leaders speaking out. We didn't have major figures from the liberal media giving it the kind of attention the issue deserved. And the reality is that when they did, it was often equivocating, often trying to do so, but only when they would at the same time decry the violence in the Middle East. Now, again, I think we need to stop hate when it happens, not to qualify our concerns. We need to recognize the common humanity in all people. And just ultimately, you know, neither side of the political spectrum is exempt from intolerance. And the belief that one side is or isn't more, no side has a monopoly on morality. And I think we've got to be willing to meet each other in the middle. That's the only way we'll get through this moment.
Let's go back to our callers now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. And hi, what Jonathan was just saying actually kind of dovetails into what I was calling to say, which is just that I feel that so many of the problems, so much of the hatred and intolerance, and even, you know, things like believing in conspiracies or that Sandy Hook was a false flag, other things like that, comes down to a lack of empathy for others and otherization of different groups of people. You know, the people who, for example, believe Sandy Hook was a false flag, you know, they don't have that or sent threats to the parents of children who died, aren't empathizing, aren't seeing those people as, you know, fellow human beings. People who don't.
I got you, Michael. We just have a couple minutes left. And Jonathan, how can we start to rebuild that empathy that Michael is hoping to see?
Empathy and kindness indeed are what we need. Now, I think we also need some other things too. I think we need accountability. So if you commit a crime, whether you're looting a store or you are rampaging through the Capitol, people need to be held accountable for their actions, again, regardless of the politics of the day. Number two, we need to meet our fellow man in the middle and recognize that while there may be things we disagree with in terms of the issues, our common humanity is far deeper and stronger. I really believe that. And I think number three, there are some things we're going to need help on, like the government getting these social media companies to finally behave with the same level of responsibility that you do on this radio station. So closing the loopholes and pushing them to put people over profits is long overdue.
Thanks for that call. Just in our last few moments, Jonathan, you've been looking head on at a lot of disturbing hate here. Coming out of it, though, do you still feel a sense of optimism?
Oh, I feel deep optimism. Look, an earlier caller was saying, you know, when times get tough, you know, people are on edge. That's true. But this country has endured world wars. It has endured economic depression. It has endured civil strife and civil war. And yet we have always come through it, survived, and thrived. This is the greatest democracy in the history of the world. I believe in American exceptionalism. I believe we are continuing on the quest for a more perfect union. So while we are not, you know, at the promised land, I do believe, to invoke Dr. King, that we will get there. And I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that we'll weather this moment and again come out stronger and sturdier on the other side.
Jonathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. We talked to him about his new book. It's out this week, called It Could Happen Here: Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. Coming up after the news, a GOP-backed investigation into the 2020 election is expanding. We'll hear what they're looking for from WPR's State Capitol reporter. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.